This is the NPR News Update for Tuesday, August 12th. I'm Curry Finelli. On the podcast today, it's primary election day in Minnesota. Despite a hotly contested GOP race to see who will take on DFL Governor Mark Dayton this fall, the Secretary of State is predicting light voter turnout. Newly released documents show Twin Cities Archbishop John Neinstedt made false statements under oath earlier this year. A federal judge has declined to order the release or transfer of two people held in the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. And so-called house museums throughout Minnesota, like the Ramsey House in St. Paul and the Glen Sheen Mansion in Duluth, are reinventing themselves to attract new visitors. Minnesotans are going to the polls today for a primary election that will narrow the field of candidates for governor and other offices. Tim Pugmire reports.
Republicans have their first competitive statewide primary in 20 years. There are four GOP candidates running for governor: business executive Scott Honor, Hennepin County Commissioner Jeff Johnson, former House Minority Leader Marty Seifert, and former House Speaker Kurt Zellers. The winner will take on DFL Governor Mark Dayton and IP candidate Hannah Nicolet in November. Democrats will make their choice for state auditor. DFL incumbent Rebecca Otto is facing a challenge from former House Minority Leader Matt Entenza. There are also nomination fights in several Minnesota House districts, including a high-profile contest in Eden Prairie between incumbent GOP Representative Jennifer Loon and challenger Sheila Keeney. Turnout for the primary is expected to be light. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
Stung by a shaky rollout, ongoing legal challenges, and deep divisions over its merits, many Democrats on the campaign trail this year are not talking much about the Affordable Care Act. But Senator Al Franken is the rare Democrat who does sometimes highlight the role he played in crafting the health care law, especially a provision he authored regarding what's known as the medical loss ratio. Our Washington reporter Brett Neely explains.
The medical loss ratio rule is pretty simple to understand. It says insurance companies have to spend 80% of the premiums they collect from people on medical care. Administrative costs, executive salaries, and everything else has to fit in the other 20%. Senior policy analyst Cynthia Cox at the Kaiser Family Foundation says the rule is an important but not well-known component of the 2010 health care law that offers two main benefits to consumers.
Consumers may get a rebate if their insurers fail to meet these requirements. The other way is that insurers have an incentive to try to keep their premiums low so that they don't have to offer a rebate.
The Department of Health and Human Services says consumers have received nearly $2 billion in rebate checks since the rule took effect in 2011. The rule has had the biggest impact in the individual health insurance market. In 2011, just over 60% of policies purchased in that market met the minimum loss ratio requirements. By 2013, more than 80% of the policies complied with the rule. Over time, rebate payments to consumers have gone down, which Cox says is a sign the law is working.
So that's sort of the ironic part about this legislation, is that when it's working, people don't necessarily get a rebate because it means that insurers were in compliance with the rule.
Senator Al Franken says the shrinking rebates mean the health insurance industry is becoming more efficient, just as the Affordable Care Act intended.
It's made insurance companies focus on, let's not spend this much on administrative costs. Let's watch our marketing. Let's watch our CEO salaries.
The provision does have its critics. Robert Book with the Health Systems Innovation Network, a consulting firm, notes that insurance companies are required to maintain cash reserves in case they have an unusually expensive year of claims to pay out. Book, who's also done work for the Conservative Heritage Foundation and American Action Forum, says that by limiting companies' overhead and profit, the medical loss ratio makes it harder for insurers to restock their reserves after a bad year.
That's a situation where if it weren't for this rule, they could make it up in a good year. This rule basically says you have to take the hit during the bad years, and you can't make it up in the good years because you have to pay rebates.
The health insurance industry initially fought the medical loss ratio when Franken proposed it, but these days appears resigned to life under the rule. Claire Cruising is the director of communications with the trade group America's Health Insurance Plans.
I think where we remain concerned is again, the very simple fact that the MLR does nothing to address those real drivers of premium increases, which is the soaring cost of medical care.
But medical costs haven't been soaring like they were 5 years ago, and have in fact slowed considerably in the past few years. The Kaiser Family Foundation says the medical loss ratio has kept premiums from rising too quickly, and estimates that the rule has saved consumers 7.5% on their premiums since taking effect. Ultimately, while the insurance industry has gone through major changes as a result of the Affordable Care Act, companies still remain profitable. Franken says the law and his provision have simply forced insurers to focus on paying for health care rather than marketing and salaries. Brett Neely, Minnesota Public Radio News, Washington.
Newly released documents show Twin Cities Archbishop John Neinstedt made false statements under oath earlier this year. Madeline Barron reports.
The documents are part of a massive lawsuit filed by a man who accuses the Archdiocese of St. Paul and Minneapolis of creating a public nuisance by keeping information on abusive priests secret. The documents contradict statements made by Neinstedt in a deposition 4 months ago about a priest accused in the 1980s of sexually assaulting two girls. Under oath, Neinstedt has said he didn't realize Father Ken LeVan was still in ministry in 2013. He said he removed LeVan as soon as he learned that the priest still helped out at Twin Cities parishes. But the documents released today show the Archbishop signed off annually on LeVan's work. The most recent report is from August of last year. Neinstedt declined an interview request. Madeline Barron, Minnesota Public Radio News.
This is the NPR News Update. A federal judge has declined to order the release or transfer of two people held in the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. Matt Sepik has more.
In a ruling, U.S. District Judge Donovan Frank denied a motion from Rhonda Bailey, the only woman in the program, to move to a less restrictive facility. According to court documents, Frank also said 24-year-old Eric Terhar, who has no adult criminal history, may not be released unconditionally at this time. Frank writes that he does not want to interfere with a class action suit against the program. Its nearly 700 clients, as the state calls them, claim their confinement is unconstitutional because most have already served prison time. Frank also said that it appears the state is preparing to move Terhar to a less restrictive setting and is willing to explore options to transfer Bailey as well. Frank says he hopes to speed up the larger class action case and set a trial for later this year. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Minneapolis City officials say the 400 Soundbar, where nine people were injured in a weekend shooting, will close indefinitely. Brant Williams reports.
City licensing manager Grant Wilson says the nightclub, located a block from Target Field, has a history of violent incidents. According to documents released by the city, since 2012, two people have been stabbed at the club. Two officers have reported being assaulted while breaking up fights, and a bouncer was shot and seriously wounded outside the club. City regulators have also cited the owner of the 400 Sound Bar in the past for not properly screening patrons and for failing to use metal detectors. The club's owner has not returned calls for comment. Police say two people were seriously wounded in this weekend's shooting. The others, including a Minnesota Viking, sustained minor gunshot wounds. Police say no arrests have been made. Brant Williams, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
This is the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Historic house museums, places like the James J. Hill House in St. Paul or Charles Lindbergh's boyhood home in Little Falls, may be of another era, but they're finding they need to adapt to this one. With some 15,000 nationwide, they're the most common kind of museum in the country. But attendance has been spiraling downward for decades, prompting many to loosen up a little bit to attract a new generation of visitors. Dan Crocker has our story.
So they began construction in Glensheen in 1905, finished in 1908. Now the time
this kind of classic historic site tour is still the Glensheen Estate's bread and butter. But fewer and fewer visitors have an appetite for this old staple of the summer family road trip. In 1981, more than 140,000 people toured the 39-bedroom Duluth Mansion on Lake Superior, built by iron mining magnate Chester Congdon. By 2012, that number had dropped to just 50,000. Similar declines have occurred nationwide, leading some historic sites to be sold to private owners, including General Robert E. Lee's boyhood home. Glensheen Interim Director Dan Hartman says the mansion can't survive if that attendance decline continues.
And so we got to find new creative ways to start bringing people back to Glensheen.
So in the past year, Glensheen has offered up more live programming, including history lectures, a discussion series, and music. Glensheen's also backed away from two long-standing practices in the museum world. Photos are now allowed inside the mansion.
Pictures are definitely allowed. Just make sure your flash is off.
And just a few weeks ago, Hartman says, staff removed some of the velvet ropes used to keep visitors away from valuable artifacts. That might seem like a minor thing, but it's a bold experiment for a historic house.
If we take these velvet ropes down, is it going to be as terrible as we think it is? And what we've learned nationally is it's not. It's definitely helped the visitor experience.
Glensheen followed the lead of the Alexander Ramsey House in St. Paul, which took down its barriers last year. 5 years ago, the home of Minnesota's first territorial governor was on the verge of closing. The Minnesota Historical Society, which operates the house, surveyed its audience. Rachel Abbott says what they heard was that people don't want a stuffy museum tour. They want to experience the house as a house.
What I mean by that is, if you have a kitchen, how can you make food in it? How can you let people smell food in it? If you have a parlor, can you actually have sort of social programs where it feels like the space is being used the way it was originally intended?
So the Ramsey House dropped tours, threw out the velvet ropes, and developed a bunch of new events like History Happy Hour, where visitors sip drinks and listen to informal history talks.
Actually having the drinks inside a historic house full of artifacts is a little bit different, and that's where the Ramsey House felt like a risky move. But what's been really interesting is it to the public, I think it doesn't look that risky at all.
The American Swedish Institute in Minneapolis made a similar transition. 2 years ago, the historic mansion opened a new cultural center and restaurant, transformed the third floor into a space for kids, and began offering what marketing director Laura Cederberg calls thinky-drinky events, mixing arts, culture, and history with cocktails.
You're seeing 80-year-olds next to 21-year-olds having a great time for music, performance, DIY craft, and really introducing new audiences into the historic mansion as a gathering place.
Cederberg says visitation, which had been flat, has doubled in just 3 years. Glensheen and the Ramsey House have also seen big jumps in visitation and revenue. But Rachel Abbott with the Minnesota Historical Society says as more and more historic houses open their doors for these events, it's rekindled a debate of access versus preservation.
How much are we willing to put those artifacts at risk in the interest of engaging people and giving them access to these places and letting them really experience the houses? I mean, certainly we don't necessarily want people to sleep in the historic beds, but that line, I think, is getting blurrier.
Abbott says so far, so good. Nothing's been broken yet. And she's not worried about competition from other museums pursuing similar strategies. History's still popular, she says. It just needs to be made more relevant, accessible, and personal. Dan Crocker, Minnesota Public Radio News, Duluth.
And finally, for the fourth time in as many seasons, the Minnesota Lynx are headed to the WNBA playoffs. That's despite injuries to key players. One of the reasons for that has been the play of Maya Moore, who many say is a favorite to earn the league's MVP honor. Peter Cox reports.
When the spotlight is on Maya Moore, she usually steps up.
Maya!
Last week, she put up 9 points in the final 4.5 minutes in a come-from-behind win over the Chicago Sky. It's been a big season for the Minnesota Lynx star player. She's the WNBA's leading scorer and set the league record for most 30-point games in a season.
Maya, in her fourth year, is about as complete a player as you can see.
Lynx coach Cheryl Reeve.
She'll tell you she's still got some things she wants to work on, and that's great. It's like every elite player in every profession. They always strive to be better, and Maya's no different with that. Her expectations of herself are greater than what any one coach or player can put on her.
Raised in Missouri and Atlanta, Moore says her mother, Catherine, inspired her work ethic.
Just watching her go to work every day as a single parent, putting food on the table and going to work and, you know, no excuses. You go to school, you do your job, and, you know, she's still a big part of my life right now and helping me with the business side of things.
Moore's hard work helped lead her suburban Atlanta high school to 3 state championships. At the University of Connecticut, Moore led the Huskies to an NCAA record 90-game winning streak. She was the top overall pick in the 2011 WNBA draft. Between her UConn days, the Lynx 2 championships, and even an Olympic gold medal, Moore has earned many trips to the White House, and this comment from President Obama.
Basically, there's like a Maya Moore wing in the White House. And when she comes, you know, we got all her stuff here. She's got a toothbrush.
Moore says her faith guides her on and off the court. She's active with Athletes in Action, a Christian sports organization.
There's a bigger picture other than getting everything that I want, you know, wanting to make sure that I'm shining a light and bringing life to every situation that I'm in. What kind of teammate am I? How do I treat my coaches? You know, how do I treat the referees? You know, all those little things. How do I interact with you know, someone who's a fan, you know, how I spend my time off the court.
On the court, Moore has much more on her shoulders this season, as several key players have been sidelined by injury. Teammate Simone Augustus says Moore has stepped up as a leader, but she's also worked hard to improve all parts of her game.
People just kind of coined her as a three-point shooter early on in her career, but now you see her mixing it up. She can shoot the jumper. She's attacking the basket. She's getting to the free throw line, which is great. But people fail to talk about her defense and how well she's improved on that end.
ESPN.com columnist Michelle Vopel has followed Moore from college through her WNBA career. She says Moore is great for the league.
When people watch her, I think it's a level of skill and athleticism that is great for marketing the game.
9-year-old Noelle Murray of Edina watched the Lynx game Thursday night with her basketball team. Her favorite player is Moore.
I try to make the right passes like she does and dribble like she does and do all the really good moves that she does. It helps me focus on what I really need to do.
After Thursday's win, Moore danced with young fans at center court. They crowded in around her, asking her questions and giving her high fives. Moore says her team has plenty of work ahead.
We want to just continue to build momentum with our identity being on the defensive end first and everything flowing from that.
The Lynx have 3 regular season games left. They host Los Angeles tonight at home. Peter Cox, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
And that's the NPR News Update for Tuesday, August 12th. I'm Perry Fidelli. Thanks for listening.